Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence. Same-sex couples will be allowed to get marriage licenses for the first time in Rhode Island on Thursday. To make life easier for couples planning to take advantage of the historic day and tie the knot, Providence City officials are offering pre-registration starting today. With all the right documents, city leaders say couples will be able to pick up their marriage licenses on August 1st. The pre-registration is open to any couple where at least one member is a Providence resident. It's also open for couples from other states planning to get married in Providence. Dozens of protesters were arrested yesterday for trespassing in an act of civil disobedience against the Brayton Point coal-fired power plant in Somerset, Massachusetts. The plant is situated on the Rhode Island-Massachusetts border, and protesters say it needs to be shut down because of pollution. Rhode Island Public Radio's Flo Jonick was at the protest and filed this report.
Hundreds of protesters from all over New England converged on the Brayton Point power plant yesterday, calling for its closure due to pollution issues. 43 of the roughly 300 protesters planned to be arrested, and they were as soon as they crossed a police line. Massachusetts state troopers slapped plastic handcuffs on their wrists and marched them away as their fellow demonstrators shouted their thanks.
Thank you! Thank you! Thank you!
Protesters say Brayton Point emits millions of tons of carbon dioxide into the air each year, as well as heavy metals such as lead, arsenic, and mercury. They're calling on Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick to close the plant down while taking into account the needs of the people who work there and of the host communities. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.
The operator of the Brayton Point power plant could not be reached for comment. While most Rhode Islanders are out drinking up the joys of beach life this summer, Providence Mayor Angel Taveras is trying to lure them back into the capital city with a series of television and radio ads that started running last week. The ads highlight popular tourism spots in the capital city and try to allay people's concerns about parking. Here's a clip from one.
Whoever said there's no parking in downtown Providence needs to come visit us. We have over 15,000 parking spaces. The city's in bloom this summer with fabulous restaurants, concerts, and more.
The spots end with these words.
So what are you waiting for?
The commercials were produced by the Providence Warwick Convention and Visitors Bureau. They're being run on all local network-affiliated stations along with some cable channels. And the Newport Folk Festival has wrapped up 3 days of live music, drawing large crowds to Fort Adams State Park. Headliners yesterday on the final day included Beck, Andrew Bird, and Ramblin' Jack Elliott. The Newport Jazz Festival gets underway this week with a performance from Natalie Cole on Friday at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. The main festival at Fort Adams State Park will include Natalie Cole, Herbie Hancock, and Chick Corea, along with dozens of upcoming artists. Some of the biggest superstars in jazz history have graced the stage at the Newport Jazz Festival, names like Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington.
Flick the wall switch and the lights go on. Turn the knob, the stove heats up. Push a button, the air conditioner hums. We all know the importance of electricity in our lives, even if we take it for granted until a hurricane or a winter nor'easter leaves us in the dark. What few of us think about as we go about our daily routine is where this power that is the blood of modern society comes from. In the last Rhode Island General Assembly session, a proposal to purchase more electricity from large Canadian hydroelectric sources was shuttled off to a study committee. For our economic, environmental, and energy future, Rhode Islanders should hope that the study recommends more reliance on hydroelectric power from our northern neighbors in the Canadian province of Quebec. According to National Grid, the state's largest electric utility, less than 5% of our state's electricity comes from hydroelectric power. Almost 40% is generated from natural gas and nearly 30% from nuclear power. Maybe all you have to know about our electricity mix is that we get more power to light our homes in Rhode Island from burning coal than from water flowing over a dam. A bit of history is relevant here. As far back as the 1960s, forward-thinking New Englanders have looked to Canadian hydropower for consistent electricity sources at stable prices. At that time, a visionary Vermont governor, Philip Hoff, proposed that his state purchase a large ownership interest in a Canadian hydro development and that the state own the power. Hoff's plan was beaten back by private utilities who opted instead to proceed with nuclear plants on the bogus theory that nuclear power would be, quote-unquote, too cheap to meter. Then in the 1970s, after the Arab oil boycotts, the snaking lines at gas stations, and the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown in Pennsylvania, New Englanders had second thoughts about hydropower from Canada. Once again, Vermont led the way, but Rhode Island political figures had a crucial role. Governor J. Joseph Garrahy and Ed Burke, Garrahy's chief energy advisor, were major advocates of a deal that brought electricity from Canada to New England. Now, Quebec and its huge province-owned hydroelectric company have power to export. Hydro-Quebec has harnessed 75 rivers, on which it operates 60 hydroelectric generating stations. Governor Lincoln Chafee has long favored importing more Canadian hydro, but after opposition from the National Grid Utility and some environmental groups, the Assembly punted the governor's legislation off to a summer study commission. National Grid says Chafee's proposal does not put the company in the best position to negotiate the best hydro deal for its customers. Some environmental groups, such as the Conservation Law Foundation and the Sierra Club, don't like the plan to string a new high-voltage transmission line through New Hampshire's White Mountains to wheel the power to southern New England. And some point to the promise of developing wind power off our Atlantic coastline as an alternative. Well, consumers and businesses ought to be skeptical of the arguments of the electric utilities in this realm. Over the years, they've done little to control electricity costs. Yes, there will always be an environmental cost to any plan to generate large-scale electricity sources. Damming rivers in Quebec has long upset native communities in the northern part of the province. Anytime humankind alters the natural world, there's a downside. The beauty of New Englanders is that we respect our history and honor the environment. The region has long been home to some of the nation's toughest environmental protection laws. The bane of this attitude is that it sometimes leads to the not-in-my-backyard syndrome that views any change as disruptive to the way we live. We need to balance the White Mountain views with the need to provide consistent electricity at prices that homeowners and manufacturers can live with. It's great to try to develop a new energy industry from the breezes that whip along our coast, but proposals such as deep water wind are still in their infancy, and the costs are much higher than the decades-old proven resources of Canadian hydropower. The much larger environmental question is why New England utilities should be allowed to burn coal in plants belching pollution when clean hydroelectric energy is available and relatively cheap. When you still have Brayton Point churning out greenhouse gases, there's no question hydro's a better alternative, says Richard Sawdick, the Vermont energy expert who helped negotiate the early Canadian hydro deals. Connecticut and Vermont have recently approved contracts to import more Canadian hydroelectricity. As you pay those air conditioning bills, Rhode Islanders ought to be asking our politicians why the Ocean State can't be in the forefront of bringing in clean, affordable energy for our 21st century economy and environment.
Providence Police Chief Hugh Clements joins me in the studio. Good morning, Chief.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with last summer. The data we got shows the police district encompassing the Elmhurst, Smith Hill, and North End neighborhoods were hit with the most crimes in July of last year. That includes a triple homicide, nearly a dozen aggravated assaults, scores of burglaries and robberies. Describe for me what was going on in that district last summer.
Yes, certainly. Last year we experienced an uptick in violence in District 7, the neighborhoods you just mentioned, including Chad Brown, the PC area, and Charles Street in Wanscook. The most serious crime was the triple homicide, and we did have an increase in gun violence in District 7, as well as the other incidents you touched upon, including robberies.
What do you think was happening that fueled that increase?
Well, there are so many factors that come into play when you experience an uptick in crime, and it could be very simply who's out of jail. And if somebody's been in jail for a couple of years and they want to take one of their disputes back on the street from a year ago, 3 years ago, the issue is the availability of firearms. So when people are prone to violence and they have access to in the availability of firearms, that is our issue.
The summer got off to a violent start, at least three murders, along with a number of shootings, including a double drive-by last month. Chief Clements, what's going on? What's behind this violence?
Well, again, it's the availability of firearms on the street, and that's our constant challenge. It's a constant struggle. It's not only in Providence, Rhode Island. It's in every city across America. In fact, our numbers are pretty consistent with last year. And in fact, over the last 20 years, our numbers have trended downwards. And there are many efforts that we make to increase driving those numbers down. And the most important thing we've done in Providence, we no longer just try to react to problems in that reactive manner. It's now in a proactive manner, and we guide ourselves towards prevention. We try to prevent crime.
Now, in New York City, police dramatically reduced crime by focusing on minor infractions. Sometimes it's called broken windows policing. But they've also caused controversy with their policy of random stops to check for guns. That's called stop and frisk. Now, police say this is effective in getting guns off the street, but it also alienates residents in many of the same neighborhoods that are most needing police protection. What are the Providence police doing? What strategies do you believe are the most effective at reducing violent crime?
In many ways, we almost identically replicate what they've done in New York, and we started the zero tolerance broken windows theory when we reformed the Community Policing Bureau. Community policing philosophy. It's not a separate bureau. It's department-wide. We decentralized our department and brought the police department to the community. Instead of being a central, traditional police model, we became a decentralized police department. As far as the stop-and-frisk policy, we do not enact the stop-and-frisk policy in Providence.
And what about people in the neighborhoods? What kind of cooperation are you getting from residents to help you solve these crimes?
Well, our partnerships in the community are great. I mean, every weekend, almost every single night, you'll see Providence Police at events, community events, church events, cultural events. So it's important to be connected and engaged with the community groups. We are part of the community, and we've learned a long time ago that we can't stop crime by ourselves. We need the help of the community. And in all honesty, we'd like to see some increased activity with our gun tip line. We haven't seen that system utilized to what we think could be a greater benefit.
What would you say to neighbors who, even with an overall decline, are still living with persistent crime of this kind? How are you working to help them?
It's a constant challenge. These are your neighborhoods. You need to pay attention to your surroundings and take control of your neighborhood. And you see something amiss, you see something unusual, and if you see something out of line, call the police department. The more information we have, whether it be a description of an individual, a description of a vehicle, or just a situation that you think requires the attention of the police, then you should call the police.
Now, the closing of the Davy Lopes pool has sparked an outcry from residents who say you need pools to keep kids cool, keep them entertained, keep them off the streets. From your perspective, Chief Clements, what role do pools and other activities play in keeping crime down in urban neighborhoods?
Well, all activities during the summer months are good to keep the young boys and girls and young men and women engaged. And we're involved in many activities with these community groups, including Project Night Vision, which is a program run up in the Chad Brown area, and it's expanded now to District 5, Joslyn.
Finally, Chief Clements, when we see headlines and watch news stories about crime, and particularly violent crime, but really all types of crime, how much do you see as this being an issue related to gang violence?
Not so much gangs like you see in Chicago or L.A., where they're organized and there's a hierarchy and there's a pecking order, but groups and loosely knit factions. Oftentimes they name themselves after a street, after a neighborhood. Now, certainly we have had our issues with certain gangs like the Latin Kings or MS-13, but when they're that organized, we use our resources and their sometimes long investigations that dismantle these groups. Like last year, we had a couple-year investigation into MS-13, and we pretty much dismantled that organization for now, as well as our, in my time, three large-scale investigations into the Latin Kings. and we dismantle them for long periods of time. But the gangs that, you know, the media may talk about oftentimes in Providence are really groups and very loosely knit. There's really not a hierarchy. They're not very organized. But nonetheless, the issue is young men in the community and their availability with firearms. And if we're all from the same street and we have three guns at our disposal and we see somebody from a rival housing development or a rival street, again, it's a recipe for disaster.
How do you tackle a problem like that when it's not these large organized gangs but these loosely affiliated groups that might be as local as one street?
Again, it's intelligence, it's communication between the respective bureaus within the police department, the patrol bureau, providing information to the plainclothes side, and vice versa. When people in the gun task force or the gang unit or detectives are armed with information, it's important that we pass that along to the patrol bureau. And our officers really do a fantastic job of taking firearms off the street. In the last 2 years, there were 134 2 years ago with an arrest and 130 firearms with an arrest last year. This year, we're up to 62. So that's a lot of firearms taken off the street of this small city. And I can only imagine last year alone, 130 firearms on the street without an apprehension or that gun being taken off the street, what the numbers would be. So it's just a constant challenge of taking these firearms off the street. And I'd say these arrests aren't easy. And again, it's a credit to the men and women of the police department. Most of these arrests, people aren't putting their hands up and saying, okay, you caught me, I have a gun. It's a foot chase. It may be a vehicle chase. It may be a wrestling match. And hopefully it's not shots fired, but certainly could be. It's danger. It's a dangerous situation, and I commend the men and women of the police department.
Well, Providence Police Chief Hugh Clements, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
On a muggy July evening, a constant stream of cars cruises down the six-block stretch of Oakland Avenue. Except for the hum of traffic, it's a quiet evening. But that's not always the case, says Chris Janko, who's pushing a motor scooter toward his home.
I mean, last year I saw some guy get shot in the car and the car went into a building. I've seen multiple fights. Just last weekend, some guy with a shotgun shot off his shotgun like two or three times outside of right in front of my house.
One block down, Jada Pitts waiting for a ride. When asked if he thinks Oakland Avenue is dangerous, he shrugs.
Actually, yeah, somewhat, but then again, not really. If a crime happens, it's probably pretty quiet. Yeah. But you probably won't know everything.
It's not the best place to live, he says, but it's okay. Oakland Avenue sits snug between Smith Street and the edge of the Providence College campus. Many residents here are students. They aren't just PC students. They're also from Johnson & Wales, Rhode Island College, and others. The pizza boxes, red Solo cups, and sofa cushions littering the front yards of empty triple-deckers paint a landscape similar to any student neighborhood in any college town in America. Last summer in July, there were 12 crimes on Oakland Avenue. They were mostly property crimes, items stolen out of cars, vandalism, a few burglaries. At one address, there's a report of vandalism, and 3 days later, a burglary.
Nobody's going to mess with a woman walking down.
Well, little do they know they're big babies, as you can see.
Kayla, too nervous to give her last name, lives on Oakland Avenue. She's taking her dogs on their daily walk. Looking over the list of crimes that happened on her street last year, she's surprised by the number.
It does, because it's really not like considered, it's not like the south side of Providence. It's, you know, PC area. It's LaSalle's right down the street.
She says her elderly neighbor complains about how the street has gone downhill since the students arrived. One after another, the triple-deckers on Oakland Avenue have been turned into student housing. You can tell by the rental signs plastered on the front for the 02908 Club. It's a property owner and management company that caters to students. The buildings have names on them, like South Beach and Cocoa Beach.
So I think that it's people who don't live, aren't from Rhode Island, they're from out of state. They don't care. They have the school time and that's it.
A few blocks down, Rob Lena sits on his front porch looking at his smartphone. He's a Johnson & Wales student who's lived in the area for the last 4 years. He's not surprised by the dozen crimes that took place on Oakland Avenue last July.
No, not at all. My house was robbed.
He says it wasn't that long ago. He woke up at 3 a.m. to see someone leaving his room. He thought maybe it was a friend or a roommate.
Next thing I know, my roommate's running inside, and he's like, yo, somebody was just in the house, like, see if anything's missing. So I'm like, oh, that's who I saw in my room. So I go and I check, and my phone's gone.
So does he feel safe living on Oakland Avenue?
You know, for the most part, I don't feel like I'm physically in danger. I mean, obviously, my, like, belongings might be in danger. You know, if you're careless and you leave doors open, I mean, you could get robbed very easily.
What sets crime in the Smith Hill neighborhood apart from other parts of Providence is that because of the student population, when they leave for the summer, crime actually cools down while it heats up elsewhere. Catherine Welch, Rhode Island Public Radio.